I'm going to speak about the Galois theory of commutative rings and of differential fields. My plan is to, and because these are already printed up, I have to say, I must stick to my plan. My plan is to speak about the Galois theory of fields as a paradigm of Galois theory. This was, of course, elementary and something you all know and understand. And then, and it's as a paradigm for categorical Galois theory. And then to speak a bit about the Galois theory of differential fields, this is less known, and what I really want to talk about are some phenomena which appear there which don't seem to fit into the standard paradigm, and which, hopefully there are some categorical insights which will explain them. So, the fundamental theorem of Galois theory of fields says that if we have a finite normal separable field extension and consider its group of automorphisms of the extension which fixed the base, then there's a one-to-one correspondence between the subgroups of the group of automorphisms and the set of subfields, intermediate subfields. Of course, the way the correspondence works is that subgroups correspond to subfields which are left fixed by the automorphism. The sort of the first step in converting this to something, to understanding this notion, is the following theorem, which I learned by reading the Chase Harrison Rosenberg memoir on Galois theory of commutative rings, although I assume that this is something which is older and was merely being recorded there at that time. But in the same context, finite normal separable field extension, group of automorphisms, and then, well, this odd notation here, CGE means E-valued functions on G. Of course, G is a finite group, and there's no topology or other structure on E. This just means functions from G to E. But then there's an isomorphism between the tensor product E tensor over F with E and this ring of functions, given by the formula that the tensor element A tensor B, the basic tensor element, evaluated at the group element sigma is A times sigma B. Now, this theorem actually captures the hard part of the correspondence in the fundamental theorem of Galois theory, because this tells you that in a sort of a trivial way, that the fixed field of the extension is the base field, and then if you have any other fixed field of the group is the base field. If you have any other subgroup which happens to have the base field as its fixed field, then it coincides with the group. That's, after all, basically that follows from counting dimensions on this C of CGE in the case of the group G and the group H. So the hard part of the fundamental theorem is somehow captured in this tensor product isomorphism. Well, so then we might just, and one did, and again, I'm just restating old-fashioned mathematics, and these restatements are also old-fashioned, that the fundamental theorem of Galois theory then can be restated in the using this tensor product isomorphism that reads naturally for you and backwards for me, that if we restate the tensor product theorem, fundamental theorem in tensor product form, we have the same finite, normal, separable field extension, the bijection between the intermediate fields, and then instead of saying subgroups, isomorphism classes of quotient subalgebras of the tensor product, that is, quotient algebras B, which satisfy three conditions, which are expressed here on the three slides. The first condition, that the map to be factors through the multiplication map. The second condition that there's some map from B to itself, which sort of fits with the interchanging factors map on the tensor product. And the third, that there's a map from B to, well, B tensor over E with B, which somehow is related to this additional map on the tensor product. I want to say a little bit about the top map. Here we have E tensor over F with E considered as an E algebra in the two natural ways on the left and the right, and then there's some kind of diagonalization which expands it, and then we require that there be some map on the on this quotient algebra B which fits there. Now, what's going on there is we're simply trying to identify which quotients of E tensor over F with E are of the form E tensor over an intermediate field with E. So if you remember the fundamental theorem in tensor product, or the tensor product theorem rather, then that says that intermediate fields and their correspondence to subgroups is somehow given by this by some isomorphism with tensors. And this is restating that. Well, the three conditions which are written there, the condition on the factoring through the multiplication map, the condition with the switch map, and this condition here with the expansion map, are basically the conditions for equivalence relation. In fact, there are conditions for equivalence relation. And again, I'm going to say that in order to have said it. But let me point out that the connection with the intermediate fields. Well, the intermediate field K leads to the quotient algebra E tensor over K with E, and the quotient algebra B leads to the field, which is the kernel of the pair of maps from E to B given, well, induced by this two maps in the tensor product. So now the group is gone explicitly, and it's simply the fundamental theorem of Galois theory of fields is simply a statement about quotients of tensor products. So let me remind you, I really feel embarrassed about doing this to an audience of experts, but I'll do it anyway. The statement of equivalence relations in diagrammatic forms. So after all, an equivalence relation on an object in the category of sets, and I'm using this funny Gothic F to stand for the final object in the category of sets, for a choice of final object in the category of sets. An equivalence relation on an object in the category of sets is, it's a subobject of the object X. It's a subobject of X cross X, and then maps which represent the fact that the equivalence relation is reflexive, symmetric, and transitive. Well, there's a condition on the diagonal map factor through this the inclusion, that's the reflexive statement, and then symmetric and transitive are expressed in these forms. Now, what these diagrams say is essentially the reverse of the diagrams from the from Galois theory. Let me simplify by saying that rather than look at the equivalence relation as this list of maps, it's just some tuple of pair of maps from this R to X, and then the three D, S, and T with the conditions which were mentioned on the previous slides. And then quotient object, well, that's a again, what we think it is, to say a quotient by an equivalence relation. I'm restating that in terms of maps. This is, again, I'm still speaking in the category of sets. Now, if I have a field extension, an equivalence relation, well, on the functor represented by the field extension, and I want to be a little bit vague about what that means right now. This is, I'm looking at some category which is rich enough that the Yoneda embedding applies. So this F algebras in which this category is taking place is let's say, the category of all commutative F algebras. But if I have a field extension, then to think of so I can identify the field E with the representable, with the functor it represents, algef E. And then to say that I have an equivalence relation on it means I have a subfunctor of this product. That is, I have something which is a subfunctor of the functor represented by E tensor over F with E. And then I would like that to be representable. So that's represented by some surjection from E tensor over F with E to some algebra B. And then whatever the conditions on the surjection which we have to have in order to have an equivalence relation, for the representable functor to have an equivalence relation, are precisely the ones that come up in the tensor product form of the fundamental theorem of Galois theory. So where I used the ST and I used K and delta for the maps in that case. Now, we should also say that the quotient of the equivalence relation, which is represented by B, if there is such, is a difference co-kernel in the same way that it's from the definition of equivalence relations, but it means sort of the same thing which appeared in, dually in the tensor product form of the fundamental theorem. So to sum up this part then, so the fundamental theorem of Galois theory for fields in tensor product form, after we pass to the category of set-valued functions, is precisely the functorialized correspondence between equivalence relations and quotients. So let me just read what I wrote. Notice what's happened. The deep fundamental theorem of Galois theory of fields in tensor product form translates into the transparent correspondence between equivalence relations and quotients of sets. So, now, there's still not the mystery, but the statement about which I meant to hold out, and I've let my slide get away from me. The statement about the identifying the tensor product with the group, and that was that's an issue, and there's something serious about that issue. But that aside from that, that the Galois theory in its classical form is the theorem I was looking for. So there's this issue which somehow takes us from the tensor product to the ring of functions on the group, produces the group from the tensor product. But aside from this business, which relates the correspondence to groups, then the Galois theory of fields is just the correspondence between equivalence relations and quotients, which is the, or if you like, the correspondence between equivalence relations and partitions, which is the simplest part, the easiest place to begin with these, with an analysis of quotient maps. Now, a lot more goes on with this, and that, just to relate a little bit of the history, even when you've understood this for fields, there's still a lot to do. For example, to deal with commutative rings, you have to decide what's separable and what's normal and what's finite. Now, actually, finite was the easiest. That was finitely generated and projective. And that separable and normal were harder, but those were worked out, and not by our ancestors. And that trying to figure out exactly how to do this for commutative rings that had idempotents and then infinitely many idempotents was a challenge which was met and then understood. And then, due to the insights of Janalidze, who figured out how this was a special case of some correspondence between relationships between equivalence relations and objects in, more general categorical situations. But the same sort of spirit went through in generality. When Bodo was mentioning that some of us here had were going to be able to see and meet authors of papers which we had only read before, I'm going to have this experience with here's a paper which finally gives this is from 1996, which gives the statement of the Galois theory of commutative rings in its correct form for the first time, that is without mistakes. And the three authors are in inverse order: myself, George Janalidze, and Carboni. And I didn't notice where the there he is. Hi. So we have met, all of us. But actually, this is the first time we've ever been in the same room together. So, fulfilling Bodo's prophecy. When one passes from commutative rings to the differential Galois theory, then some more complicated things begin to happen. And I want to devote most of my time to telling you about this situation. So, first of all, to tell you about the differential Galois theory. So I'm shifting gears now. F is a differential field of characteristic zero with a derivation, and it happens to have algebraically closed field of constants. The field of constants of the derivation are the zeros of the derivation. Then there are various kinds of situations, but the basic sort of differential Galois situation is what's called a Picard-Vaisseau extension. That's where we have a field E which contains F, and it's a Picard-Vaisseau extension if it's connected to the solutions of a monic linear differential operator over the field F. So I've given you such an operator here, L. Its coefficients A sub I belong to the field F. And then for the field E to be a Picard-Vaisseau extension, I need that E is generated as a differential field over F by solutions of that differential equation. There are enough solutions, that is, the set of solutions form a vector space of dimension over the field of contents, the constants, that degree of the differential operator. And then this condition that there are no new constants in the extension, this is to prevent adjoining solutions of equations to which you already have solutions. Now, this definition, which is a standard one, and one that we work with in differential algebra, refers to a differential operator, a differential equation. You can get away from that a little bit by instead looking at the group of automorphisms of E over F and requiring that E be generated differentially by a vector space which is finite dimensional over the constants and which is stable under that group of automorphisms. And then that sort of hides the fact that there is, that you can produce such an equation. But what's striking about this situation is that we don't have anything like the situation with fields or with commutative rings, where we have some natural definition, where separable is sort of there for us in a natural conceptual way. We have to deal with this equation, or if not the equation, then a group of automorphisms, which is sort of the same sort of extra structure. I want to tell you what differential Galois theory is. Because of the things I want to say later, I'm going to discuss not only this situation, but the sort of infinite situation. So an infinite Picard-Vessio extension is something which is a union of Picard-Vessio extensions. And then there is a differential Galois theory, the one for infinite Picard-Vessio extensions, due to Kovacic, Picard-Vessio extensions itself as well, originally to Picard and Vessio, but then later recast by various people, especially by Ellis Colchin. And there's a good fundamental theorem for the infinite differential Galois theory, namely the group of automorphisms of the field extension has a nice structure of a proaffine algebraic group, that means inverse limit of algebraic groups. And there's a one-to-one lattice inverting correspondence between differential subfields and Zariski closed subgroups. The correspondence going in the usual way, subgroups and fixed fields. And it also has a nice situation that if you happen to have an intermediate Picard-Vessio extension, then the associated subgroup is normal and vice versa. So in that situation, we're very much like we are in the case of fields or in the case of commutative rings. Now, up to this point, I've been talking about fundamental theorem Galois theory. Not fundamental theorem of Galois theory, but fundamental theorem Galois theory, which is correspondence between subobjects and subobjects of something else. There's also universal cover Galois theory, where the idea is to begin with, to obtain some universal cover, that's the topological version, or algebraic closure, or separable closure, and then to demonstrate the connection between to understand the Galois extensions of the base as descent from trivial things over the universal cover. And it's at that place where the differential Galois theory is different from the situation with fields or with commutative rings. Now, when I was talking about fundamental theorem Galois theory in the case of fields, I made the point that there was the trivial part, the connection between the equivalence relations and quotients, and then the other part, the theorem that identified the tensor product, or produced the group out of the tensor product. Now, I should say that it's a theorem of Colchin's that in the differential case for the Picard-Vecchio extension, that the group appears out of the in the same way, not quite out of the tensor product. What you have to do is you begin with the field F. Inside of E, you take all the elements of E which satisfy linear differential equations over F. That's a commutative ring. And then you show that that commutative ring is the coordinate ring of the scalar extension from the field of constants up to the field F of the ring of rational functions on the differential Galois group thought of as an algebraic group. And that's the Colchin's theorem passes in a trivial way by direct limits to this infinite case, so that we have the same sort of statement here, that this differential Galois group, this proaffine algebraic group, its coordinate ring appears naturally as a in the well, in fact, in that same form. You take all the elements of E which satisfy linear differential equations over F, that commutative ring is the coordinate ring of G extended from E to extended from C to F. And there's a minor sort of glitch there that you have to actually, that isomorphism doesn't strictly hold until you pass to the algebraic closure of the field F, but we'll, that's left aside. Okay, so that's the interpretation of tensor product as functions on a group. Fundamental theorem, Galois theory, is the correspondence between equivalence relations and quotients. Now, but I'm beginning to talk now about universal cover Galois theory. So, first of all, there exists an infinite Picard-Vecchio extension, E-naught of the field F, which contains an isomorphic copy of every Picard-Vecchio extension of F, and it's unique up to isomorphism, infinite Picard-Vecchio extension of F with this property. This is a this fact is a sort of a counting argument type reasoning in the same way that the algebraic closure of a field is produced. Logicians know this just by models of first order theories, so that this is something which is to them this is not a theorem, this is just an observation. But there's the construction I have in mind of this extension is the following one, which is was useful for commutative rings and could also be done for fields. Namely, you consider all of the possible extensions of F, the finite Picard-Vecchio extensions of F, take their tensor product. Okay, so that gives you something in which they all fit, and then form an appropriate differential field out of that. Now, the things which are needed to get to get Picard-Vecchio extensions, they're generated by solutions that'll happen in the tensor product, and that there's full sets of solutions that'll for everything. That's not a problem. It's this second point here that there are that the constants of E are those of F, that there's no new constants is the main issue. There are a number of ways to see this in, for say, for finite tensor products, but to see that this is possible in an infinite tensor product turns out to be difficult. Once you know it's true, for example, by these logical observations I should say from logic, then you can proceed in other ways. But this is a sticking point. Anyway, if you can get around that, so you take the tensor product, that's a ring, you mod out some maximal differential ideal, you have a field, and then that's something which contains every Picard-Vassiot extension. Now, one of the reasons it's pleasant to think about that as a tensor product is then it has this property which is indicated here on the slide, and it's an important one. The differential automorphisms of the base field then lift to differential automorphisms of this thing which is described in Theorem 1, which is called, I call a complete Picard-Vassiot compositum. That it's sort of obvious, right, if you have automorphisms of the base field and then you have a Picard-Vassiot extension, that automorphism changes the coefficients of a differential equation. But if you have all of the equations, then changing the one equation just moves it to a different factor of the tensor product. So from that, you can reason about this extension of automorphisms theorem. That extension of automorphisms, of course, is a trivial matter in the case of fields, extending automorphisms to algebraic closures. But this is a sort of a serious matter in the differential case, and that construction certainly makes it possible to do so. Now, I mentioned that there were things about Picard-Vassiot extensions which were different from the situation with fields. And it's, you know, you'd think when you're going from fields to commutative rings, finite, normal, separable, that finite is the easy one, and separable you have to work on, and normal. But it turned out that finite is the big problem here. And here's the sort of thing which happens. If you take you can take a Picard-Vassiot extension of the base field F, so that's some finite differential Galois extension. And then you can take some Picard-Vassiot extension of that. That's another finite Galois extension. Now, you don't expect that a Galois extension of a Galois extension to be a Galois extension. That doesn't happen for fields, but it doesn't matter because it's embeddable in a Galois extension. This fails for differential fields. That if you start with a differential field extension, a Picard-Vassiot extension of a differential field, a Galois extension, simple one, elementary one, all of those are technical terms, a basic one, and then take another basic one, and you end up with something which is not embeddable in a Picard-Vassiot extension. Right? So this is a real problem. In commutative rings, if you take an integral extension of an integral extension, you have an integral extension, but this is not happening here. You can take, if you do one of these odd sort of little towers and look at all the elements of the tower which satisfy linear differential equation over the base field, that's not big enough to give you the whole field as a quotient ring. So there are problems there. The way you see that you have examples of that type is by automorphisms. If there, you form one of these towers, I should have written the example on a slide, but I didn't, but you form one of these towers where there's a problem. If it's going to be a Galois extension, then the automorphisms of the first extension over the base would lift to automorphisms of the Galois extension over the base. But, you know, when you start changing coefficients in linear differential equations, you can get infinitely many algebraically independent, infinitely many equations with algebraically independent solutions. I mean, that's sort of elementary to see if you think about equations of the form y prime equals alpha y. You change alpha by simply adding a constant to it, and then, you know, you have you're dealing with exponentials which don't have well, okay. So there, anyway, so this problem comes up. This problem could be ignored, but once you have this fact with the complete Picard-Vaisseau compositums, that you can lift automorphisms, then you realize that these extensions, although they don't appear they can't appear inside a Picard-Vaisseau extension, well, they can appear in the following context. That is, we just start off with the base field, F, and then we build a chain that's by taking, if you happen to have a Picard-Vaisseau extension, proper Picard-Vaisseau extension of the base, then you take the Picard-Vaisseau compositum, and then you just continue building a chain until you inductively, and then you can take the union of the chain, and I'm using GI to stand for the differential automorphisms of the elements of the fields in the chain over the base F. And the union of the chain is K infinity, and that's something which has no proper Picard-Vaisseau extension. So this is sort of something nice up there at the top. And then if we look at the differential automorphisms of K infinity over F, its group of differential automorphisms is this, the inverse limit of these groups, GI. These are all pro-algebraic groups, and let's ignore this last statement here on the bottom. I don't think I want to take time to explain it, but that the layers in this chain come from taking Picard-Vaisseau compositums, and in each case, these are the corresponding differential Galois group is a pro-affine, pro-algebraic group. Unfortunately, examples show that the groups GI themselves are not necessarily pro-algebraic. So let me remind you what the groups GI are. They're these, the tower of Picard-Vaisseau extensions, and then the groups are the groups of the steps. So those are not themselves pro-algebraic groups. This situation what this means is that if we stop here, if we look here at K infinity, that the differential subfields there are not fixed fields of subgroups of this G infinity. So there's something else which is taking place here. And this is this is discomforting, to say the least, if you're looking for a fundamental theorem of Galois theory, that it's simply not true that there's a Galois correspondence based on the groups which produces this. Now, I wanted to give you some indication of where this comes from, the fact that these groups are not pro-algebraic groups. And, let's see, I think I can give you some feeling for it, although I'm not going to run through all of the slides I have identified here. It comes from instead of considering all differential equations, just considering the differential equations of the form y prime equals an element of the base field. So something which can be solved by an antiderivative. So if we restrict our attention just to extensions which are generated by antiderivatives or towers of antiderivatives, that's a smaller class of Picard-Vaisseau extensions. And what we end up with are the class of Picard-Vecchio extensions, which have differential Galois groups that happen to be unipotent groups. Well, we could form the composita of this in the same way that we formed the compositum of all Picard-Vecchio extensions. And the resulting thing we'll call a Picard-Vecchio antiderivative closure. Now there's a if I happen to have a Picard-Vecchio extension which is produced by adjoining antiderivatives, then its differential Galois group is unipotent. If I look at the one-dimensional unipotent group GA and happen to take an extension of that, then trying to find a Picard-Vecchio extension of the which contains my given one and whose differential Galois group is isomorphic to the one in the middle. This is called the lifting problem in Galois theory or differential Galois theory. And we'll say that the field F has the lifting property with respect to extensions by unipotents if every lifting property has a problem has a solution. And then it's a fact that the differential field C of T, rational functions in one variable over an algebraically closed field of characteristic zero, actually the complex numbers, happens to have the lifting property. This is a consequence of the fact that it's actually more complex, stronger situation that every connected algebraic group appears as a differential Galois group of a Picard-Vecchio extension of C of T. Then, if we happen to have a field whose Picard-Vecchio antiderivative closure has the lifting property, then that implies that it's that the differential Galois group of its Picard-Vecchio antiderivative closure, which I'm calling here G-bar, happens to, any extension of it by GA happens to split. Now, this is a, this property is a statement that the group G-bar is a free group in appropriate categories, so it's a free pro-unipotent group. And so we can say that the Picard-Vecchio antiderivative closure of the rational function field C of T differential Galois group is a free pro-unipotent group. Now, in one of the slides that that I skipped, I actually defined groups HI for the tower of Picard-Vecchio antiderivative closures of C of T in the same way that the groups GI were defined for the Picard-Vecchio compositum of a general differential field. In the case of C of T, these examples I mentioned to you earlier of Picard-Vecchio extensions of Picard-Vecchio extensions which are not embeddable in Picard-Vecchio extensions, those examples imply that the epimorphism from H2 to H1, the first two steps in this tower, doesn't split, which means that since H1, according to the theorem, is a free pro-unipotent group, H2 couldn't possibly be a pro-algebraic group in any way, because if it were, then we would have a splitting. And so even though the kernel here is, in fact, a free pro-unipotent group, so this H2, the first step here, is free pro-unipotent extended by free pro-unipotent. Now, this is obviously an odd situation. We have a group arising in a perfectly natural algebraic fashion that's a non-trivial extension of a free object by a free object, all right? So this intrigues me, And I hope it intrigues you, and so perhaps before the week is out, we'll have some insight into where this kind of structure is coming from. So to wrap that up, let me say that the problem, although it's expressed here in some complicated way about extensions of free pro-unipotent by free pro-unipotent, is related to the fact that we really don't understand how to say that a finite extension of a finite extension is a finite extension in the differential algebraic situation. Okay, and that's, I'm done.